This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Today, as the world is being murdered, what are you doing to defend the Earth? That is a question from a recent video by our next guest, deep green thinker Derek Jensen. He is the author of 25 books, including A Language Older Than Words, his 2007 book, As the World Burns, 50 Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial, Resistance Against Empire, and Earth at Risk, Building a Resistance Movement to Save the Planet. Derek Jensen also writes magazine articles, and he appears in videos, including a great series on YouTube. We played a sample from one of Derek's YouTube videos in last week's Radio EcoShock show. From somewhere in Northern California, Derek Jensen, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
It's been a while, since 2007. I guess you've had a few new thoughts since then.
Yeah, it's a while. Things have certainly changed, or things have gotten worse.
They have, and I sort of document that every show. I'd like to go a little bit back towards your roots. Wikipedia tells me that you earned a Bachelor of Science in Mineral Engineering Physics at the Colorado School of Mines. Then you got a Master's in Fine Arts and Creative Writing from Eastern Washington University. That looks like a big life switch. What happened?
Well, I wanted to be a writer ever since I was a kid. And then in high school, I took calculus. And then I did what so many people who take calculus do, which is go into science. And I got a scholarship to the School of Mines, and I couldn't really have afforded to go to school otherwise. And the School of Mines is a really good school. It's one of the top engineering schools in the world. And I didn't really like it very much. But when I was there, I think in my sophomore year, I went to the registrar at the University of Colorado. I was thinking about switching up there and taking English or something, I don't know. And the registrar looked at me and said, "So you have a scholarship to the School of Mines, and you want to transfer to the University of Colorado? Are you crazy?" So I continued the School of Mines. I wanted to quit, and my mom said something to me that was one of the smartest things anybody's ever said to me, which is, after my junior year, she said, "Would you rather go the rest of your life saying you have a degree in physics, or would you rather go the rest of your life saying you have 3 years toward a degree in physics?" And I finished it out, and at the same time, I had this sort of habit of asking people if they liked their jobs. About 90% said no. So I started asking, what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? And I would ask my fellow students, you know, "Are you enjoying the School of Mines?" And they said, "No, not really." And I said, "Well, are you going to enjoy what you do afterwards?" And they said, "No, not really, but I'll be able to buy a nice car." And I had fellow students who were 20 and 21 and 22 talking about what they're going to do when they retire. And that just seemed crazy to me. So, you know, I'm only going to live this life once, and I wanted to do what I was called to do. So I wanted to be a writer, but still I have to live within this capitalist system. I have to make a living. So I borrowed the money to become a small-scale commercial beekeeper because I figured I could work really hard during part of the year, and then during part of the year I would not be working so hard and I could teach myself how to write. And I did that for several years. It's a very hard way to make a living. I did that for several years, and then I realized I had pretty much taught myself as much as I could teach myself about writing. I had learned as much as I could simply by reading, you know, the greats, and decided it was time to actually go back to school. And then I went and got a master's and enjoyed it. That was probably out of all my years of schooling, that was the only time I really enjoyed school. So that was that transformation.
And you've got a degree in science, and I talk to a lot of top scientists from dozens of specialties here on Radio EcoShock. But in the past, you've had kind of an uneasy relationship with science. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, thanks for bringing that up. And I feel like I've tried to be clear about science, and I feel like I may not have been as clear as I had hoped to be because, well, I guess I want to separate myself from postmodernism. I have a critique of science, and it's a very different critique of science than the sort of postmodern critique, which is that science is just another story, and there's a big war going on right now in academia between sort of social sciences, SIC, S-I-C, and science, where there's a sort of postmodern notion that there is no reality and there's only stories. So when I hear a lot of people make a critique of science, sometimes they're doing that, and that kind of drives me crazy. And my own critique of science is simply that science is one way to know the world. It is not the only way, and And there are assumptions that come with science. I love this line by Robert Coombs, which is, unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture. And there are some assumptions that science carries that can influence our relationship. And a great example of that is Richard Dawkins has this great, great line about, and this is pretty close to a direct quote, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. And that's true. So, you know, if you turn on a light switch, then light comes out of the light bulbs, and that's how we know that these processes by which science and engineering have been able to rig up an electrical system for your house, that's why we know that those sort of principles that they're working on are true, because we get results from them. And that's all true. But one of the problems is that if you and I were in the same room and I'm holding a gun and a hoop and I put the gun on you and I point the gun at you and I say, on the count of three, you're going to jump through this hoop or I'm going to shoot you, and then what do you know? On the count of three, you jump through the hoop on command, and I have just made matter and energy jump through hoops on command, and I predicted what would happen and when. I'm a genius. But the problem is that if I do that, that's probably going to destroy any possibility of friendship between us, because I just put a gun on you. And my point in bringing all this up is that so many indigenous people have said that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that the Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor, or the world consists of resources to be exploited, as opposed to other beings to enter into a relationship with. And so my critique of science basically boils down to, it's really good for some things. It's really good for developing a system such that, where are you, by the way, physically?
Oh, I'm on the West Coast. I'm just about 5 miles east of Vancouver.
Okay. Vancouver, Washington?
No, Vancouver in Canada.
Okay. So basically, science is great for making it so I can be just 20 miles south of the border of Oregon on the coast of California, and you can be up in Canada, and we can be talking. And it can, you know, these signals can go through the wires, and then you can broadcast them out. Science is really good for doing things like that. Science is not so good for living sustainably in place for 10,000 years. I want to go back to the Richard Dawkins thing, that one of the things he does, he says science bases its claims to truth. Epistemology is how we know something's true. It's a fancy word that just means how we know something is true. And what he's done is he has connected how we know something's true with our ability to dominate it. And that's a really sneaky assumption that has made its way, but permeates a lot of science, that it's really not just about describing things, but it's also about describing things so you can control them. And that basically my entire critique of science boils down to that. But there's a pretty cool thing about science, which is, I mean, about, 25 years now or so, no, 20 years ago, I interviewed this guy, Cleve Baxter. He's the guy who was famous for attaching a lie detector to a plant, and then when he would think about threatening the plant, it would respond. You know, forget all that. The real point is, he had this great line he said to me, which is, science's ability to measure is going to create a crisis in science, in that it presumes that everyone around us, that the presumption has been that plants don't communicate, etc., that plants don't make decisions. But the measuring ability of science is getting to be so great that they will no longer be able to deny that plants, for example, can communicate. And we're running into that right now. It's pretty cool that I wrote about this in my recent book, Myth of Human Supremacy, that if a caterpillar is eating a leaf, then the plant might send out messages to other plants saying, hey, this certain species of caterpillar is eating the leaves. You might want to change the taste of your leaves. You might want to toxify your leaves to protect yourself from this caterpillar or this giraffe or whatever it is. And they communicate through sending out chemical messages. Or a great example of this is, when I lived in Spokane, I had this tree that got a big aphid infestation. And maybe after a couple weeks of that, just hordes of ladybugs showed up and started eating the aphids. And what had happened is, the tree was sending out chemical messages in pheromones that would just waft through the air. And you could either say, hey, there's a party going on here, or you could also say they were dialing 911. You know, it's like, hey, we need some help. Can you come over? Either way, it doesn't matter. The point is, they were sending out messages that were picked up by the ladybugs, and the ladybugs came to then eat the aphids. And there's this guy, Stefano Mancuso, who's been able to develop a dictionary of about 2,500 terms, I believe, 1,500, 2,500 terms, I don't remember, basically different chemical signals that the plants can send to other species and to their own species, to others in their neighborhood. And so my point about that is that science's ability to measure is becoming so great that we are being faced with the understanding that a lot of indigenous people have had forever, which is that everyone is sentient, everyone is thinking, everybody's communicating. So my problem with science is basically just some fundamental assumptions having to do with control.
There are supposedly three currents of environmentalism. There's light green, dark green, and now bright green. What do you think about those categories, and what do you think about me calling you dark green?
Well, I prefer deep green.
Okay.
And I know what bright green is, and I'm going to take a quick stab, like one-sentence stab at light green. If I'm wrong, you can tell me. Light green would be if we just make sort of superficial changes, things will be okay. Is that light green?
I think so. Technological changes.
I thought that was bright green.
I'm confused myself.
Okay, I'm just going to make something up then.
All right.
Okay, here's my understanding, and I could be wrong, and I'm just saying this up front. My understanding of light green would be that if we just pass a couple laws, things will be okay. My understanding of bright green is that through the basically technology will save us, and that if we convert to solar and wind and we do 100% recycling, that things will be okay. And then what I would call deep green and what I guess bright greens would call dark green is the belief that the problems we face are far deeper than simply getting a Democrat in the White House or passing a couple of laws, that the problems are functional and systemic, and that they have to do with how we perceive the world, and they go back to the sort of the core of the culture. That's my thumbnail difference of the three.
This is Radio EcoShock, and after listening to countless climate scientists explain we're heading into doom, it is time to listen to voices from Deep Green Resistance. We're talking with the author and philosopher Derek Jensen. You recently started what I hope will be a series of YouTube videos called Without a Net, and you draw unknown prompts from a cookie jar like an improv for philosophy and social critique. So here's a couple of quick questions from the Radio EcoShock Without a Net jar. Have you ever appeared on mainstream television?
Is Democracy Now mainstream?
No. I'm thinking the commercial machine, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS, anything like that.
I'm trying to be completely honest. I'm trying to think, not in any sort of real way. I probably was, in the background at a baseball game sometime or something.
Yeah.
But no, and effectively, no. And I do have a quick story about that that's kind of funny. Years ago, John Stossel asked me to be on his program, and he was going to fly me to New York. And my mom prohibited me from doing it because Stossel is such a jerk. She said, absolutely not. You know, I won't take care of your animals when you're gone. Don't go. Because I don't know how much your listeners know about John Stossel. He's an anti-environmental. He's just horrible. And one quick thing about Stossel is I talked to his assistant for a couple hours about a week before whether I was or wasn't going to do the show. His big thing was that there are more trees in the country now than there were prior to the beginning of cutting down the trees. And I said, this is ridiculous. That's counting a tiny little tree the same as, you know, a huge old growth tree. And we're talking about this. And I said, whatever you do, please do one thing, which is do not use white-tailed deer as an example of how clear-cutting helps wildlife, because white-tailed deer like the boundaries between field and forest, as opposed to other species who can only live in deep forests. I said, so please, whatever you do, I don't care what else you do in the program, don't use white-tailed deer as an example, because they're a terrible example, because, of course, white-tailed deer populations are going up, because, A, there's a lot more edges between forest and clear-cuts, and, B, the predators have been killed, so you know there aren't the mountain lions and the wolves to take them down. So whatever you do, do not use this as an example. And then you know what he did in this program? He used that as an example of why it's good. So short answer to your question, no, I have not been on mainstream TV.
Okay, next question, Derek Jensen. Why are some people mad at you?
lots of reasons. The interesting thing about that is that I have, over the years, gotten... probably 3,000 or 4,000 pieces of hate mail. And only about 400 or 500 of those are from right-wingers. And the right-wingers mainly came from one thing I said. And the one thing I said that really made the right-wingers mad was that after the Deepwater Horizon spill, I said that the decision-makers, all the way from the top down to the lower-level decision-makers who made that decision to cut safety corners on that, they should all have been tried for murder and killing the, what was it, 8 or 12 workers who died, and also the Gulf of Mexico. And if they were found guilty, they should have been executed. And I wasn't saying we should lynch them. I was actually saying we should go through process. There's precedents for this, too, by the way. The Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, Bhopal, he was tried in absentia in India and sentenced to hang, and then the United States wouldn't extradite him. Anyway, so I suggested that, and the right wing just went apoplectic. And I got bazillions of death threats, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that. But the main reason I've gotten the hate mail over the years has been, it's been from vegans because I eat meat. It's been from anti-car activists because I drive a car. It's been from people because I have a bank account, because I get paid when I do university events. And really what it boils down to is the notion that lifestyle change is sufficient for social change, as opposed to believing in organized political, including militant, when appropriate, resistance. And so it really, the distinction has boiled down to those who believe that lifestyle changes are sufficient have sent me just boatloads of hate mail over the years. And that continues to this day. And we can talk more about the why some people don't like me if you want, but that's my short answer.
Good enough. Well, I've just got one left in the cookie jar here, and it's, what do you think about the Green Party and its leader in the last American election, Jill Stein?
You're going to hear something from a male you don't often hear, which is, I don't know much about her, and so I'm not going to give an opinion. Usually, since I'm a guy, I go ahead and give an opinion to any question I'm asked. But I will say about the Greens that I see them as a decent... So is that heavy sigh? Is that a good enough answer? I think that we desperately need to break the stranglehold of the two-party, one-party system in the United States. So they do present a bit better of an alternative on that, but they don't nearly go far enough for me, and they also can sort of fall into some liberal silliness sometimes. When I have voted in American elections, in U.S. elections, I have I voted for Greens for a while. I voted for Nader. So I do that because I can't bring myself to... You know, we can talk about whether, you know, the point of voting, but I can't bring myself to vote for a Democrat. And so I have done them or the Peace and Freedom Party and some of the other small parties. I do think that we do need some robust shifting of the political spectrum. You know, I really like what Gail Dines says about the left in the United States, that the left is, if you define any sort of reasonable left as being at base anti-capitalist, there is no left in the United States. And so it's nice to have someone at least trying to push that a little bit. I wish they had more stronger teeth.
More radical.
Yeah.
You know, I've tuned into your work since the early 2000s, and you were speaking out really early, I thought, on violence and abuse of women. And now we have the Me Too movement. What do you take from this rebirth of women's emergence from the violence of patriarchy?
I think it's great. I mean, I think it's great that women are speaking out, and I think it's great that it is gaining some traction, and I think it's great that there are at least some men who are facing consequences for their abusive behavior. One of the things that I find really interesting to watch, or really interesting to read about through history, is how societies change and how quite often you can have movement towards something getting better, but the underlying hatred that caused the original atrocity will find another way to manifest. And one really great example of that is after chattel slavery ended, well, race-based chattel slavery more or less ended after the American Civil War, then it only took about 10 years or less for some of the early Jim Crow laws to start getting passed, and for the, you know, deprived with the Southern whites deprived of their right to steal the labor and lives of people of African descent, it didn't take long to come up with, for example, vagrancy laws, where now they could simply arrest somebody and then send them to prison and get their labor once again. And so then after that, we get the sort of prison industrial complex. So something that I find really both fascinating and horrifying to watch is to see how there will be these great strides made and then the backlash against them, and how the backlash will sort of change form so that no longer is it chattel slavery, but now it's vagrancy slavery, or it's, you know, some other, you know, cussing on Sunday slavery or something, and how the underlying imperative to enslave in this case ends up getting still manifested. And so I see that, you know, that there's great movement being made with women having the courage to come forward and tell their stories. Just today, I was looking at the ESPN website, and the MMA fighter Paige VanZant is saying that she was sexually assaulted when she was a teenager, and she's having the courage to come out and talk about this. So I think it's really great that there is a forum for this happening. That part's wonderful. And then at the same time, we're seeing, you know, like pornography is becoming more and more open and part of the culture. And we're seeing a lot of, I guess what I'm trying to say is it's not so simple as all the water flowing in one direction, like a great river moving toward a sea of liberation, which is just the world's worst metaphor, but that's fine. It's not all that. There are eddies and currents that and countercurrents. And so it's a good thing, but there are also various backlashes that also need to be attended to. And we see this with environmental stuff. We see this. I don't know if I'm anticipating another question here, but I'll just mention this. You can either go with it or not. That you know, environmentalism made some really great strides, but over the last 30 years, there's been this transformation of environmentalism from being about protecting wild places and wild beings, and toward attempting to sustain this culture that is actually causing the problems in the first place. And there's been sort of a neoliberal takeover of environmentalism, and also a takeover to make it not only about sustaining, like there's this line by the head scientist for the Nature Conservancy where he talks about how we need to not protect biodiversity for its own sake, but conservation or environmentalism needs to be measured by how well it serves humans. And that's quite an extraordinary statement. It's a very, very long way of answering your question. I think it's great that women are speaking out, and I think that there will be backlashes and countercurrents, and to go to a cliche, the struggle continues.
Well, I would offer you this story from Edmund O. Wilson, the great biologist, and he said that when ants decide to change their nests, that a whole bunch of the ants start carrying the eggs away towards the new nest, but then other ants come along from the same group and say, oh no, what are you doing? Put everything back in the hole. And so you can have like a flow of ants going one way and then a smaller flow going the other way, carrying the eggs back. And they only move the nests when the last of the ants going backwards give up, and now you've got a new nest.
Well, I love that, and thank you. Well, so I just wanted to stop for a second and acknowledge that your questions are great, so thank you. And then the thing with the ants, and that reminds me of what, I never can remember who this was, Max Planck maybe? It was somebody or another who said that the way scientific debates are usually resolved are not because one side convinces the other, but because the people who believe one of the models dies out of old age. You know, you get one model for how life works or how the atom works, and then you get this other competing model, and nobody ever convinces anybody, but, you know, one side just grows old.
I'm hoping that will happen with climate change denial, that generation of, it's mostly old guys, but old people die off, and the young people coming out of the colleges who are seeing it happen right around them just don't have any time for it and demand some climate action.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm talking with the voice of Deep Green Resistance, Derek Jensen, a voice, I should say, really. And it's great to be talking with you too, Derek. I mean, if my questions are any good, it's because I've been following your work and learning from you. And you have said that the industrial civilization must fall. Are you sticking with that? And would that be a good thing, really?
Yes, I'm sticking with that. And would that be a good thing? Let's put an asterisk on would that be a good thing and come back to that. And my memory is not what it used to be. So if I forget, please don't hesitate to remind me. So far as it having to come down, I wrote A Language Older Than Words, and really one of the points of that is how this culture is sort of psychologically irredeemable. And then I wrote Culture of Make-Believe, and I approached it from a sociological perspective, that sort of with the system of social rewards that we have will lead to atrocity. And then when I started to write Endgame, it's like, how do I approach this question of sustainability from a different perspective? And partly I was getting at, if you know, you can argue psychology, you can argue sociology, but you can't really argue resource movement. And what I mean by all this is that civilization can be defined as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. Now, it's defensible both linguistically and historically. And that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? So a city I defined as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And a couple things happen when you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable. And what I mean by that is if you require the importation of resources, that means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, and as your city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area. I mean, think about New York City. Where does the city get its wood? Where does it get the materials for brick? Where does it get the materials for asphalt? Where does it get the materials for... Where does the poop go? Where does the other garbage go? Where does it get its water? And cities have, from the beginning, required a countryside from which they can harvest, from which they can take. And as your city grows, you will be taking from an ever larger area. And I contrast cities with, say, camps or villages that don't require the importation of resources, that the Talawa, on whose land I now live, they lived here for at least 12,500 years. They've been carbon dated to that long. And when the dominant culture arrived here 180 years ago, the place was a paradise in terms of food. I mean, they ate salmon, and then they ate some salmon, and then they also ate elk, and they ate shellfish, and they ate some marine mammals, huckleberries, and a lot of salmon. And the salmon were still here in huge numbers when the dominant culture arrived. And my point is that they were living within what the land could supply. And, you know, people oftentimes like to say, you know, Indians affected their land base too. But here's the difference, is that they were planning on living in place for the next 500 years. And if you're planning on living in place for the next 500 years, your land use decisions will be different. I'm not saying the Talawa were perfect. I'm not saying, you know, they were sort of noble savages who nobody ever got mad at each other and nobody ever did anything bad. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is they lasted here for 12,500 years without destroying the place. That's all I'm saying at this moment. And they did that without requiring the importation of resources. They, once again, lived with what the land gave willingly. And here's a really important thing to think about is, you know, I love reading old, and also breaks my heart, to read what places were like prior to conquest. You know, you can read accounts of so many passenger pigeons that they darkened the sky for days at a time, and you read accounts of whales that they're so thick that they're a hazard to shipping. I'm not making this up. And you read accounts of fish that are so thick that they slow down your boat. And I did a talk in San Francisco a few years ago, and before I did the talk, I looked up what San Francisco, the bay, was like prior to conquest. And the early Spanish explorers described so many sea lions that it looked like the entire bay was paved with them. And there'd be troops of grizzly bears. You know, where I live right now, I see bears every day. Haven't seen them today, but saw them yesterday. I'll see them later today, probably. I see black bears. This time of year, usually a mother and yearling. And I get all excited about that until I remember what I read a while ago, that if you live near a river, and I live right near a stream, if you live near a river, you would see a grizzly bear in Northern California every 15 minutes. So I love reading the accounts of what life was like and what the world was like. And the important thing here is for us to ask, how did life get to be so fecund in the first place? How did these places get to be so rich with life? And the way they got to be so rich with life is by every creature making the world a better place by its birth and death. That's how it has to happen. That's the only way it can happen, is salmon make the forest a better place by being respond, or by being born, you know, by coming into existence, and then by coming up and dying.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
But we are actually less than a century away from disaster.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with Derek Jensen.
We have this idea, this is one of those crazy assumptions that unquestioned assumptions that guides the culture. We have this idea that evolution is based on competition. It's based on survival of the fittest, the meanest, the most capitalist. It's based on whoever can exploit their surroundings the best. And that's not how life works, that those creatures that survive in the long run have survived in the long run, and the way you survive in the long run is by improving your habitat. And so you don't do that by denuding the landscape of whatever resource it is you're denuding. And the other thing that happens as soon as you require the importation of resources is your way of life has to be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable, because if the people in the next watershed over won't trade you for it and you need it, you're going to take it. So here's an example of that, is that I was getting interviewed several years ago by this guy from Nature Online, and he was a dedicated Marxist who believed that it was possible to have an industrial society with only voluntary exchanges, with no coercion whatsoever. And I said, great, do you have cities? He said, yes. I said, so how do you get around in your city? He said, by bus. I said, what's your bus made of? He said, by mines, or they're made from minerals. I said, okay, so how do you get people to go in mines? He said, well, you just pay them a lot. I said, well, you know, mining is really such a horrible existence that it was one of the first forms of slavery, but I will give you that one. You can just pay them a ton, or whatever. But we know that mines create pollution. They do this by definition. You can't avoid it. And they pollute water. And so what do you do about the people who live next to the river? He said, well, you pay them to move. I said, what if they've been living there for 5,000 years and they don't want to move? Their ancestors are there. He said, you pay them more. I said, they're not going to move because they will not leave their ancestors. He said, well, how many of them are there? I said, I don't know, 400. What difference does it make? He said, well, the million people in the city vote, and they vote that the 400 people near the river have to move, and so you kick them out. I said, so what you're saying is that you have moved within less than a minute from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire, land theft, and genocide against indigenous people all within a minute just so you can have a bust. And my point is that for us to think about industrial civilization not being sustainable, what we have to do is just follow back the supply chains for the various materials we have. So where did they get the plastics, and what are the processes involved to bring the plastics together for this telephone that I'm holding in my hand? And where do we get the copper for the wiring in your house? Where do we get all of these materials? Have to come from somewhere. They don't just appear out of nowhere. And what do we leave behind? You know, one of my books was called What Do We Leave Behind? Or What We Leave Behind? And it's that book is really following the same question, except what happens to the stuff we dump that at one point, not even very long ago, all of our trash was food for someone else. If I eat an apple and I throw the core out, the core is going to be gone tomorrow because a possum's going to eat it, or slugs are going to eat it, bears going to eat it, somebody's going to eat it. And when I poop, slugs eat that, bacteria eat it, plants eat it. But now we've created, for example, with plastics were created intentionally because they wanted to make something that wouldn't decay. And another word for decay is another phrase for decay is somebody eating it. And we have, this culture has intentionally created stuff that no one has ever eaten. And obviously that causes problems because that has broken the nutrient chain upon which all of life is based. And I want to say one more thing, and then I'll just shut up about this, that it's a tiny little thing I've been doing for the past year that I just think is so fun, which is I read somewhere that mealworms can eat styrofoam. They have bacteria in their guts who can digest, who can break the chemical bonds of styrofoam and turn it into nutrients. And I had raised mealworms when I was a kid, and so I bought some mealworms online, and what do you know, they're eating styrofoam. It's pretty cool. And I just harvested my first mealworm poop not very long ago. I've got like, oh, how many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 15 large shoebox things full of mealworms and styrofoam, and then also I feed them some greens. Anyway, I harvested the first mealworm poop, and I put it on my houseplants. And the cool thing is that fungus is growing all over the mealworm poop. And what that means is that the styrofoam bonds have been broken, because if I just put styrofoam on top of it, the fungus wouldn't be able to eat it. So basically, in this case, I haven't been able to do it. The mealworms have been able to bring some styrofoam back into the nutrient chain. That makes me very happy. But that's not the answer to the larger question. Back to the larger question. Yeah, this whole way of life is inherently unsustainable.
All right, but there is that daydream out there, and it goes like this. The world's richest people will realize the planet is in trouble and organize amongst themselves to save us. Will the billionaires save us?
No. Part of the reason we can say that is, who is us is one question, and that's not a rhetorical question. Who is us? When you say, will they save us?
Well, yeah. The people who work for them, I guess, or the people who live in the countries they used to inhabit, or, good question.
It's certainly not Pacific lampreys, and it's not pipistrelle bats. The mainstream climate activists, one of the things I talk about often is that all the so-called solutions to global warming that we see presented by the mainstream, what they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is having to conform to industrial capitalism. And that's insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because the real world has to be primary, because without a real world, you don't have any social system whatsoever. So the real world has to be, the natural world has to be more important than any social system. You know, I can condense all of my work down to one basic premise, which is this culture is not sustainable. It will end at some point. And when it ends, I want for there to be as much life as possible on this planet. That's it. We've just condensed 25 books down to, two sentences, three sentences, however many. So when we see a lot of these billionaires, what they're attempting to do is attempting to maintain this culture just a little bit longer. They're not doing this for the natural world. I mean, for crying out loud, you have, Elon Musk is one of the reasons he's pushing this whole thing for Mars is because he thinks that, basically the Earth is doomed. And that seems a pretty evident statement of his lack of concern for the effects of this culture on the natural world. And, okay, I'm going to back off from what I just said. When we just said rich people are not going to save us, I'm thinking of people like him or Zuckerberg or any of these other people who, for the most part, are human supremacists and don't care about the natural world. But I had this interesting thing happen a year ago that was really cool. It's that I was invited to participate in the annual board meeting of the company Patagonia. You know, Patagonia has funded good parts, by which I don't mean like solar cells. I mean they've funded protecting land. They've funded good parts of the environmental movement for the last 25 years. They've done wonderful work between Yvonne Chouinard and Doug and Chris Tompkins. It's fabulous work. And I went to to their board meeting, wasn't really sure what to expect, because they're like $500 million company, $700 million company. They're a big company, not huge, but big. And it was really wonderful that it was cool talking to people who understood what I was saying earlier about the chain of supply stuff. They'll understand that even though they're making this eco-groovy stuff, that's not sufficient, that they're still killing the planet. And they are attempting to do really good work by protecting land. And I think that that is one of the most important things that rich people can do, is attempt to protect as much of the natural world as possible. And when I say natural world, that includes traditional indigenous people living there. It does not include mining. It doesn't include logging. But it does include people living subsistence lives there. I mean, the question is, does this person, I mean, here's the real question for this rich person, this theoretical rich person, do they want to keep the bauxite in the mountain? Or do they want to pull the bauxite out and make it into aluminum? And if they want to pull the bauxite out and make it into aluminum, then they're not helping the planet.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with Derek Jensen. As you know, Derek, the greatest show on earth is now carried on cable TV. It's in the newspapers like New York Times, The Washington Post. Who can compete With the spectacle of the Donald Trump unreality show, it's hard to look away, even for me. Is the American government actually collapsing? And can the economy be far behind?
So given your questions, I'm just annoyed that I haven't been on here in 10 years. These are great questions. Thank you. And, you know, A, it is a spectacle. It's quite extraordinary. I was at my mom's a little while ago, and we were watching that spectacle, and we were also watching the spectacle just today of Zuckerberg testifying before Congress or before the Senate. And, you know, it is quite striking political theater. And I keep thinking about a couple things. One is that I remember the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings back when I was 30 or something, and fairly newly politicized. And I was kind of chewing my nails as to whether Clarence Thomas was going to get confirmed. And then, of course, he did get confirmed. And I realized that a lot of the stuff that we see is exactly what you just said. It's a show. And it's a reality show just like any other, and it's scripted just like any other. I don't mean like in a conspiracy theory sense. I mean that I love what my friend George Raffin says about how you don't have to have a conspiracy when everybody thinks the same. When everybody is a booster of capitalism, you know, you're going to have one thing. And then I think also about sort of the collapse of Rome and the slow collapse over, what, 1,000 years? And I think about, which ours is not going to last that long, but, you know, we're increasingly having, I mean, like, Donald Trump's kind of a buffoon. And he reminds me of some of the buffoonish emperors in Rome. And we are getting a good show as the world burns, you know? And is the American economy or is the American government collapsing? Oh, I never answered the question you asked a minute ago. I want to go back to the asterisk. Remember the one about is it a good thing?
Yeah, is it a good thing if the industrial civilization collapses?
Depends on your perspective. From my individual physical perspective, I have Crohn's disease and also some other health conditions, and I'll be dead in 6 months. So from that perspective, no, but from the perspective, but my life is not more important than the health of the planet. From the perspective of coho salmon, they want it down. From the perspective of prairie dogs, they want it down. From the perspective of traditional indigenous people still living on their land, they want it down. You know, I asked years ago Anuradha Mittal and then also Vandana Shiva if the poor people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow, and they both said yes, of course. And there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. And there are people starving to death because of the global economy all over the world. There are, of course, you know, farmers who were driven off their land, subsistence farmers in Mexico driven off their land by NAFTA. And the poor people, the very poor the world over, if the grid collapsed, they would not be harmed at all because they don't have access to electricity in the first place. And what they do have is people from Europe stealing their land. And I asked Vandana Shiva about the people, the poor people in Mumbai, for example. Would they be better off or would they just starve to death? And she said, no, they'd be better off too because the people in the slums of Mumbai are not there because they want to be. They're there because they were forced off their land. And if you have the land that is now used for cash crops, for tea, for export, if you have that land, if the people who stole that land no longer have the support of a government, they will immediately go back to their subsistence farming. So for even the poor, this would be a good thing. For those of us who have access to the Donald Trump show and who have access to ESPN 24 hours a day, we will lose our comforts or elegancies. But that's what happens when you have a way of life that's based on, I mean, that's the thing, is it's all a zero-sum game. Our comforts or elegancies come from somewhere else. And the only reason we don't see all this violence is because we're living behind a gated community, and the gated community is guarded by the U.S. military. The U.S. military doesn't exist just for the heck of it. It exists to make access to resources possible. Anyway, so now back to the Donald Trump show. You know, I've been having one of my sisters is very, very far right wing, and she and I both thought that Obama was going to be the last president of the United States back when he was elected. She, because she's very right wing, and she thought that he was going to have a coup and he was going to then, you know, institute a liberal, you know, left wing government that would last forever. And me, because the economy of 2008 really, the collapse of the economy in 2008, I thought it was going to be sort of make cascading system failure. And we were both wrong. I think that the collapse is going to be slower than either my sister or I had anticipated. And once again, my sister and I are looking at this collapse from entirely different perspectives. I don't think that Donald Trump is the end. You know, like I said, the Roman Empire was able to limp along for quite a long while, and this one won't be able to limp along for as long because the global economy is, because resource extraction has made it so the natural world is collapsing much more quickly, and also because the interconnectedness of the global economy makes it so, you know, in the ancient Roman Empire, you could have partial collapses. You could have a collapse here, but because it was not so interdependent, you could not have the collapse elsewhere. But when we require coltan from the Democratic Republic of Congo, the economy is increasingly top-heavy and is increasingly reliant on... It's like, you know, people talk about having a so-called renewable economy, but I was interviewing Alice Friedman about that, who has written about diesel trucks especially. And basically, diesel is incredibly energy dense. You have a lot more energy stored per unit, per mass. And so you can have a semi-truck that can have a payload of 60,000 pounds with a fuel load of, I don't know, 500 pounds or something, and it can go 500 miles. I could be off. Maybe it's. I don't know how much. Maybe the fuel weighs 100 pounds. I don't know how much the fuel weighs, but it doesn't weigh that much. And if you were to do this with batteries, you would have to have, for the same range, you would have to have a 55,000-pound battery for a total 60,000-pound payload, which only leaves you 5,000 pounds for transportation. So they can have these trucks for locally, the electric trucks for locally, like for UPS, but you can't have them for long haul. And my point is that the entire economy is dependent on that. The entire economy, everything you see right now, I don't remember her numbers, but it was basically like everything you see has been on 10 different trucks or 7 different trucks or a huge number of trucks. And so my point is that the economy is really dependent upon that sort of, on the global transportation system, which is based on oil, and oil is a uniquely dense source of energy. And so, yeah, I think it's all going to come down. It'll come down in fits and starts, and we will definitely see it, but I don't know when.
I was watching a recent video called Undercutting Assumptions that you did, and you were talking about the cultural bedrock idea of land ownership. And I'm thinking about it, and I wondered how we would carry some of your reconceptions through such a crash. And I thought, well, maybe your work is really waiting for an audience in the future.
Well, thanks for saying that. And, you know, sometimes I feel like that I'm writing... It won't do any good at that point, but I am writing for somebody to go, gosh, he was right. But what I'm really trying to do is, okay, I got really excited during Arab Spring because I was so excited with all these people demonstrating for democracy. And a friend of mine pointed out that there's a difference between mobilizing and organizing. And mobilizing you can do short term, organizing takes longer to do. And we saw that in Arab Spring, where the winners of the first round were really the sort of pro-democracy forces who basically mobilized through Facebook or through social media or through, you know, sort of superficial means, using superficial and value neutral sense here. But the winners of the second round were, in Egypt, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood. And one reason is because they were more highly organized. They've been organizing for 80 years. And then the winners of the third round, of course, was the U.S.-backed military, because they'd been organizing even longer and had even more resources. And my point is that organizing takes time, and changing culture takes time. And you can't, you know, I read this line years ago where this one guy said, it takes 10 years to change your mind. And for me, that sometimes is true, and sometimes it's only a couple years. I know when I first read John Livingston saying that he believes evolution is primarily based on cooperation, not competition, I was thinking, man, this guy's crazy. And then it was like 3 or 4 years later, with no discernible transition, I was finding myself unable to conceptualize the notion that evolution could be based exclusively on competition. It just didn't work for me anymore. And that took 3 or 4 years. So in many ways, that's what my work is trying to do, is lay the groundwork for other people to be able to pick it up and take it further. And that takes time, and that's one of the problems we have, is we don't really have time. There are 200 species went extinct today, and 200 species go extinct tomorrow. We don't have a lot of time, which is one reason I write so many books, is because I'm desperate, and I'm trying to do this. I'm trying to move these to shift the culture as fast as I can. And another thing that's very hard to think about, but is also true, is Peggy Reeve Sanday talked about. She studied why some cultures have high rates of rape and some cultures have low rates of rape, and she found that there are characteristics that can mark certain high rape cultures, and some are what we'd expect. If women are treated poorly generally, it's probably a high rape culture. If they're highly militarized, it's probably a high rape culture. Those are all what we'd expect. But there was one that I found really interesting, which is if there's a history of ecological dislocation in the last 300 to 400 years. And that says two things to me. One of them is that when patriarchal civic society collapses, or when societies collapse, or when they undergo trauma, sometimes men take it out on women. And we see this, for example, you know, when a mill closes, then oftentimes rates of domestic violence go up. We see this. I'm not saying it's okay. I'm not saying, oh, this explains it. What I'm saying is that's a marker. We should recognize that sort of correlation. And one of the reasons we should recognize is because no matter for what reason, this culture is going to collapse. And when it collapses, men's violence against women is going to increase. And as it collapses, white entitlement will also come to the fore. That's one of the things I'm really proud of with the culture of make-believe, is I pretty much predicted the sort of rise of the Tea Party and now alt-right stuff, in that what we see is that when there are economic hardship, oftentimes those who have been at the top of the heap will, instead of blaming capitalism for their woes, they will blame new immigrants. They will blame Jews, in the case of Germany. They will blame African Americans or Mexican Americans, in the case of white people in this country. And you see this pretty predictably. And so my point is, one of the reasons I write is because I want to help inoculate us as much as possible from the harmful effects of that crash that is going to come, no matter that is in process and will continue. And so if you can recognize before the crash comes that as crashes come, men's violence against women increases, you may be able to diminish or to stop at least some of that violence against women. And so that's one of the reasons that I write as I do. You know, I love the book Lord Jim, and in this book, it's a novel by Joseph Conrad, and in this book, this very honorable character is faced with a terrible decision. He's a crew member on a ship that they think is sinking, and, you know, the crew is supposed to go down with the ship, but he is a coward in the moment, and he makes the wrong decision, jumps off the ship into a lifeboat, and then he spends the rest of his life making up for that terrible decision. That's not a spoiler. That happens early in the book. And the point is that we can all make terrible decisions in the moment. This is why athletes train. This is why people do martial arts, is because you want to have it be muscle memory so that when the crisis comes, you act in a proper way. And one of the things I'm trying to do with my writing is to think through these issues in a calm time when we have the luxury to think about them and to have these conversations, so that as things become increasingly chaotic, it can be a part of our muscle and body memory that we should act in a different fashion. Does that make sense?
It does, but sadly I have to say we're running out of time for this show and maybe for Action to Save What Is Left. So, Derek Jensen, how do people find you on the net?
At www.derekjensen.org, DerekJensen.org, and my book should be available in libraries and bookstores, insofar as bookstores still exist.
You've got tons of great books, and I was going to ask you what would be the book you would recommend to the first-time Derek Jensen reader.
You know, maybe A Language Older Than Words, or maybe Myth of Human Supremacy.
From America's West Coast, we've been speaking with the author of 25 books to choose from, and he's a leading figure in the Deep Green Resistance, Derek Jensen, and I'll put links to some of Derek's work and his contact points in my own Radio EcoShock blog, published Wednesdays, at ecoshock.org. And as he says, you can go directly to derekjensen.org. Derek, thank you for hanging out with us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, gosh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, doing what I do. It is eerie when a description of a past age seems to explain what we will be facing as the climate shifts this century. Around 4,270 years ago, the grasslands of Egypt disappeared, leaving a vast desert. Archaeologists claim to have discovered a regional climate shift during a time of written records and great buildings like the pyramids. Here is a short clip from a film, Egypt, The End of the Age of Pyramids, part of a Twilight of Civilizations series produced by Art France. I found it uploaded to YouTube. I went for the history, but heard it as a documentary of our future.
An ibex. Further away, we can see two oryx and a prowling lion. What does this mean? It shows that the pyramids were not in a desert environment as they are now. There was savanna here, African savanna, and a huge variety of wild animals. The climate changed. The wildlife disappeared.
In the century leading up to the revolution, the savanna gave way to desert. And the animals needing the most water disappeared from the kingdom. Where's the proof? Audran Lebrousse believes he found it when studying the texts in Pepi I's funerary chamber.
There's an important clue here. This elephant. This animal is not at all realistic. It's obvious that the Egyptians were no longer familiar with this animal. They had probably kept a sketchy model on a papyrus. They knew that it had to have trunk and tusks. But there was nothing realistic about this animal anymore. And yet we know that the Egyptians were masters of realism. This is simply an idea of an elephant, of something that had not existed in Egypt for a very long time. So here we have absolute proof of climate change.
The elephant was probably the first to disappear, before the lion or the giraffe, which was still part of the landscape. But the question remains, when did this climate change occur exactly? A few kilometers away, a team from the German Archaeological Institute may have found the answer. These scientists are excavating the causeway of King Snefru, Khufu's father. On studying the mud bricks used to make the causeway, they realized it had been restored 300 years after its construction, during the reign of Pepe I. That's to say, at the time climate change is thought to have occurred. This causeway, which led to the pharaoh's famous pyramid, was originally open to the elements. It was later turned into a long roofed corridor.
That was a description of regional climate change in Egypt from the film Egypt, The Age of the Pyramids. Thousands of our great buildings will not go underneath blowing sand, but under the rising seas and great storm surges. As in ancient times, animals and plants will also disappear, but this time around the world. Please tell others that climate change is a real danger beyond imagination, but tracked by science. Become a climate activist, a part-time activist, or at least a person brave enough to speak out and tell everyone. I'm Alex Smith. Join me once again as we wrestle with the dragon on Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.